and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics, 5 days a week. I'm Roz Taylor. You may have heard me banging on about trust recently as I promote my book about it, but I'm not the only one preoccupied with it. Britons are very distrustful of government, and one of the reasons is the cronyism and corruption of the past half decade. We've fallen to our lowest ever ranking in the Transparency International corruption ratings. But what can we do about it? Aren't they all as bad as each other? One man who understands the workings of government and has some ideas for fixing it is Tim Durrant, Programme Director at the Institute for Government. Welcome back to The Bunker, Tim.
Hi, Roz. It's great to be back.
As we talk, it's been 18 months since the anti-corruption czar resigned. Rishi Sunak promised a new era of probity when he became PM. Why can't he appoint one?
I mean, probably he would just say, you know, it's too busy. There's lots of other stuff going on. And perhaps he would argue that it's not too much of a risk. But perhaps there's nobody who is interested in that role. Perhaps it's seen as too big. I'm not sure. I think they often go to sort of friendly backbenchers. And I think the government is slowly working through its friendly backbenchers at the moment. So it's a difficult position to take on. And I think given the political context at the moment, I'm not surprised that there aren't lots of people beating down the door to do it.
The role of anti-corruption czar is too big. Okay, right. It's not a great sign, is it? When I last interviewed you, we were talking about the ministerial code, which is the guidance for how ministers should behave. You argue at the IFG that it's out of date. How do you think it needs to change?
One of the things we think is really important to update is rules around social media. So since the ministerial code was first made public in the late 90s, when Tony Blair came in, it's not really updated with the kind of the way that government works in the 21st century. So there have been examples of ministers being criticised for using social media to attack political opponents or journalists in some cases as well. And we think there's a clear need for better guidance there. We also think the way that ministers communicate, or we know that the way ministers communicate has changed. The widespread use of WhatsApp in government is a good example. And actually, there are bits of guidance inside government, but something clear in the ministerial code setting out what is and isn't acceptable is the best way to ensure that ministers know what's expected of them and what any sanctions might be if they don't uphold those standards.
So an example of that might be Kemi Badenoch, who has attacked opponents and a journalist in the past, I think on Twitter, now called X. And of course, the whole WhatsApp during the pandemic and all the decisions that were made then.
Exactly. Those are the examples I was thinking of as well. And I think technology changes, the world changes, and government needs to continue to adapt to those changes. That doesn't mean banning these things or stopping ministers from using them. What it means is setting out clear expectations so that they can be held accountable by the public.
One of the current problems with the ministerial code is that any possible breach of it requires the Prime Minister's say-so in order to be investigated. Who would decide instead what should and shouldn't be investigated? Or is this the kind of job that an anti-corruption czar would do if there was an anti-corruption czar?
No, this falls more to the independent advisor on ministers' interests. And that person is currently Sir Laurie Magnus, who was appointed by the Prime Minister last year. And I think that role would continue to have the ability to investigate this stuff. What the current situation is that he can investigate as long as the PM gives him permission. And it says in the terms of reference, that permission will normally be granted. It's not likely that the PM would withhold that. But it's still a formal check in the process. What we've said is they should be able to investigate allegations, regardless of whether the PM sort of explicitly gives them the green light or not. Because if that independent advisor is to be properly independent, they should have that ability to start their own investigations. The risk with that situation is that anyone can write to them and say, well, I think you should investigate this minister because they did something I disagree with, or I think you should investigate this person because, you know, they said something mean. And so in the situation where they do have the power to do their own investigations, they need to have really clear kind of guidelines and thresholds about what they will and won't investigate, and they need to be able to defend that. And I think part of the problem we've had over the last few years is because there's been so much focus on ministerial behaviour and ministerial standards, but the people doing this role have tended to be quite sort of low profile, kind of, you know, behind the scenes, which makes sense to a certain extent, but they're not able to set out why, or haven't chosen to set out why they do and don't do things in certain ways. And I think for them to be truly independent, to live up to that name, then a bit more independence in terms of who they investigate, but also a bit more independence to define what they're doing in the role and defend that would be really helpful.
So Laurie Magnus is, I'm not sure if he's a member of the Conservative Party, presumably not, but he's a baronet, he's chair of Historic England, he was a financier in the City of London, and presumably he was appointed by Rishi Sunak personally. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, currently, you know, the full title is the Prime Minister's Independent Advisor on Ministers' Interests. And so they work directly to the Prime Minister. They are appointed by the PM. It's not like appointments for big public bodies. You know, there's no sort of interview process. There's, I'm sure there are interview processes, but there's no kind of panel. There's no kind of shortlisting. There's no parliamentary hearing. It is a job explicitly working for the PM.
So I guess that has the advantage that Rishi Sunak presumably trusts him because he appointed him. But on the other hand, he's not really properly independent, is he?
No, I think that's right. And I think another way to strengthen the independence of the role would be to be clear about term lengths. So independent regulators often have sort of fixed terms and there's no expectation of renewal because that gives them that bit of heft that they can say, look, I'm in this job. It's quite hard to get rid of them. And there's no expectation that they are going to go for the job again. So they're not trying to curry favour. They are able to act independently. And I think that would be an important reform to the role as well.
You also want the lobbying register rules to change. How did David Cameron get around those when he was lobbying the government on behalf of Greensill Capital when he was out of government?
So the current register of lobbyists, which was set up under David Cameron's government, is explicitly for consultant lobbyists. So it's those people who work for firms or individuals who work on behalf of other firms, rather than in-house lobbyists. So the kind of public affairs department of corporations, which is what Cameron was doing when he was working for Greensill. He was an employee of Greensill. He wasn't doing it on a contracted basis, and therefore he wasn't caught by the regulations. We know that a lot of the lobbying industry don't think this situation is satisfactory. The Chartered Institute of Public Relations, they've got a big campaign calling for the register to be expanded to those in-house lobbyists because that's where the bulk of lobbying happens. And I think it's important to say at this point, you know, lobbying sometimes is seen as a dirty word, but actually, fundamentally, what it means is interest groups bringing their interests to government, and that is a good thing. We live in a democracy, and people should be able to present their opinions and their arguments as to why government should or shouldn't do something. The risk is that it's seen as this kind of underhand thing or sort of, you know, the old boys network where people get together in smoke-filled rooms and make these decisions. And actually, the lobbying industry itself wants to try and tackle that image and say, no, this is an important part of the kind of policy-making process and we want to be transparent about it. And we think it's important that everyone who's doing these valuable roles is subject to the same rules and regulations.
So that could be quite an easy rule to change because you'd have the lobbying industry's buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would create bureaucracy for firms and obviously within government itself, there would be people managing this expanded register. It would need legislative change. And there are interesting sort of edge cases where you think, okay, well, how widely do you define lobbying? So are we talking just about commercial businesses or are we talking about charities that are trying to convince government of something? Are we talking about think tanks? You know, it's an interesting question in the world of think tanks. A lot of what I do at the Institute for Government and colleagues here and at other think tanks is talk to people in government. Would we be caught by a more widely drawn piece of legislation? Potentially. So it's not straightforward, but I think the need for change is widely recognised.
We know that Sunak may very well not be PM by the end of this year. What has Keir Starmer promised on government ethics? He's got Sue Gray as his chief of staff. She's the woman who wrote the report on Partygate, listeners will remember. What's he promising?
So Starmer has been quite outspoken about this, and indeed the Labour Party as a whole have been quite outspoken about this. I think it's fair to say, you know, they particularly at the height of the sort of Partygate scandals, they saw this very much as a kind of dividing line between themselves and the government. They wanted to show that they would take rules and standards more seriously, that they would be squeaky clean, I suppose. And their big kind of flagship commitment on this is for a new independent integrity and ethics commission, the detail of which I think they're still working out. But the idea is rather than having this kind of current sort of patchwork of different regulators and independent bodies that look after specific aspects of public life, they'd bring those together into one new organisation, which would streamline the processes and make it clear who is responsible for investigating and upholding different rules.
Do you think his plan goes far enough? I know you say it's still being worked through, but from the signals that we have so far.
So I think it's an interesting idea. I think the important thing with all of this stuff is there's got to be trust. any organisation like this is about trust. I think the focus has got to be on getting the right people in who can command the trust of the politicians or the civil servants that they're going to be kind of overseeing. But I also think ultimately it's going to come down to the behaviour and the attitude of the Prime Minister. So one of the reasons why I think people felt that government behaved as if the rules didn't apply to them was because under Boris Johnson, there seemed to be a sense that the rules literally didn't apply to them. You know, during the lockdowns, people were so angry about those parties because everybody else was making all of these sacrifices. And we saw these pictures and this news reporting of what was happening in and around Downing Street. And if you have a prime minister who is very clear, both in what they say, but in terms of the decisions they make, that they expect their colleagues to behave in a certain way, and if they don't, then there will be clear sanctions. I think that will really sort of shift the dial a bit. So again, to go back to the Boris Johnson era, one of the other cases from that period was when Priti Patel, as Home Secretary, was accused of bullying civil servants. And it came out that Johnson had said we were going to throw our arms around her and protect her from those allegations, rather than saying, well, let's investigate and find out what's happened and perhaps take her to task for that behaviour. If Starmer, you know, clearly he has this image of, you know, he's a lawyer, he's a serious person, he expects people to abide by the rules. It, you know, he will want to kind of show that that's how he's going to do things. But I think the real proof of it will be in if such a situation arises, if he's prime minister, how does he deal with it? If he says, well, look, I'm sorry, this person, you know, you've broken the rules, you can no longer stay in my government. I think that'll be a real shift in approach. To give Rishi Sunak his credit, he has done that. Nadeem Zahawi was found to have broken the ministerial code. Dominic Raab was found to have bullied his civil servants. And he got rid of both of those ministers from his government. So it's not like Labour are the only ones who will do this differently.
Starmer has been quite unequivocal about ethics. He said, I think, that he'd sack Rachel Reeves if she breached the ministerial code. That's going to put a lot of pressure on his new government, isn't it? The press are going to go all in on trying to find something and pressuring this new body, if it comes to exist, to investigate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, you know, he has set himself quite a high bar there. I think what's interesting, though, is Labour, they do seem to sort of recognise that they've set themselves that high bar. So we've had Angela Rayner here at the Institute, last year at some point, talking about this stuff. And someone asked her, well, you know, it's very easy for you to kind of criticise the Conservatives, but not everyone in Labour is perfect either. There will be mistakes. And she said, yeah, no, we know that not everyone is perfect. People will do things wrong. But the difference is we will hold those people to account. We will uphold the rules. And again, you know, they are talking the talk. The question will be, do they walk the walk when the situation presents itself? Because I think inevitably it will. I'm not assuming Rachel Reeves will break the ministerial code, but something will happen and there will be a question. And the fact that Labour have made such a big deal of it as one of their kind of attacks against the Conservatives, as you say, Roz, will mean, I think, that the media are like, well, but you said all of these things. Why, you know, you've got to do the same thing. And we saw that at PMQs this week with the Prime Minister and Starmer kind of trading blows about who's cleaned up their party better and which party upholds standards better and all the rest of it. And I think that is going to continue to be a theme during the election campaign and afterwards.
Last year, Starmer said MPs shouldn't have second jobs unless they were a professional requirement. Now, I know this isn't, strictly speaking, a question of ethics, but I wanted to ask you about it because it's something I think that people do take exception to. In the past couple of years, we've seen Tory MPs take very well-paid positions with GB News. In the case of Lee Anderson, no longer with the Tory whip, of course, but £100,000 a year, £30,000 a month for Jacob Rees-Mogg. So this isn't part of your report, but do you think it erodes trust when MPs moonlight to this extent?
So I think there's two issues there, aren't there? One is the sort of second job thing. And I think there is an argument for, yes, the profession, so lawyers and doctors and all the rest of it, you know, they need to keep up their professional qualifications. That's a value of having those kind of people in Parliament. But also, we want parliamentarians who understand the country, who can bring different experiences into Westminster. And so having second jobs that don't take time away, but if they're allowing them to get different viewpoints and experience different aspects of policy that is being made in Westminster, I think those are a benefit. The specifics on kind of MPs as television presenters, I think, are really interesting. And it's it's again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the idea of, you know, the kind of rules and systems not keeping track with the modern world, right? This wasn't a thing 10 years ago, but with GB News and other sort of talk news TV channels, there are more opportunities for this kind of thing. I think it does absolutely erode trust. I mean, it's the kind of, you know, which hat are these people wearing? Are they supposed to be an impartial news reporter, or are they supposed to be a Conservative MP, which is what they are? And you see sometimes, you know, these kind of odd situations where you have one Conservative MP interviewing another about Conservative Party policy, which, you know, is great, but is that really sort of broadcast news, or is that a sort of, you know, soft party political campaign discussion? And I think, again, it's a wider question than those specific cases, but it's symptomatic of the fact that we are in a fast-changing world, and there hasn't really been a kind of root and branch assessment of how our sort of ethical standards and rules around what we expect of MPs and ministers. There hasn't been that root and branch assessment for a good long time.
Yes, it's interesting because it's not precisely a conflict of interest. But at the same time, is it ethical for an MP to be spending less time on the very difficult job that is being an MP and getting rewarded for it? It's a difficult one, isn't it? I don't know. It doesn't seem to me sustainable.
No, I think you're right. I don't think the current situation is sustainable. What I think MPs would argue, and I do have some sympathy for this, is ultimately there is a democratic test every 4 or 5 years, and if their constituents aren't happy with what they've been doing, then they can vote them out. I think a lot of the time in our system, you know, the whole sort of we don't have a written constitution, the kind of good chaps theory of government whereby everyone is expected to just behave appropriately, the way that a lot of the UK works is it comes down to political pressures and kind of political management rather than anything sort of formal and formulaic. And I think in that case, again, and we've seen it with some of the by-elections over the last few months, you know, particularly recently with the by-elections, particularly a Conservative MP has been seen as sort of, you know, behaving badly, then the opposition parties have gone in quite hard on that person and sometimes overturned the seats. And I think that democratic sort of backstop has got to be the ultimate assessment in all of these things.
Another thing you recommend in the report is stronger protections for civil service whistleblowers. When might this have been useful? Just talk us through some instances recently when whistleblowers have not been treated as they should have been.
Well, two things come to mind. So one is, you mentioned earlier Sue Gray. Obviously, yeah, she first came to kind of national prominence was when she was writing the report on the Downing Street parties. And one of her recommendations was there needed to be stronger provision for whistleblowers then, because she said some junior officials apparently did feel that what was happening during the pandemic wasn't in keeping with the spirit of the rules, but weren't able to kind of raise those concerns, or didn't feel if they did that their concerns were listened to and acted upon. So there's that. And then some of the other kind of high profile things recently, a couple of Foreign Office officials gave evidence to the Foreign Affairs Committee over the evacuation of British forces and personnel and support staff in Kabul when the Taliban retook the capital. So there was some fairly detailed evidence from officials who'd been working on that issue, showing what they thought were really quite important failings in the way that the Foreign Office was managing things. And I think that was of huge value to understanding how decision-making had worked and what could be improved. And inherently, the government and the civil service tends to be quite sort of closed and want to learn lessons internally. They don't necessarily like opening up and talking about the things that they've not done so well. So those people tried to kind of burst that open and bring some external scrutiny, which I think is valuable. And I think the recognition of those people by the politicians was quite high. But ultimately, I think both of them lost their job. One, I think, might have resigned. One was fired because of what they'd done. And there's still a sense, I think, that the civil service would rather kind of, I guess, not air its dirty laundry and sort things out internally rather than bringing in a bit more kind of sunlight.
Thanks so much, Tim. Look forward to talking to you again when the first Labour scandal hits.
Can't wait.
Tim's report on rebuilding trust in government is available on the Institute for Government website. You can support The Bunker in a small way. It's as little as £3 a month, by searching for Patreon Bunker Podcast. That's what keeps us going, so we're really grateful for your support. I'm Ros Taylor, and thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.